Okay, part five of Rabbi Dr. Ellis weekend. It's for those who haven't heard him yet. I want to welcome Shavua Tov. Rabbi Dr. Ellis just received his PhD about 2 weeks ago at Brandeis University. He wrote his thesis on emerging rabbinic authority in the 19th century. He's in the midst of publishing a documentary history of modern Orthodoxy that is set to come out in the next couple of months. He is living in Boston with his wife and two-year-old child, and please God, they're expecting another one in another month. And they'll be moving to Chicago in the summer to take on a position at Skokie, a graduate of the Smicha program at Yeshiva University. And like I say, he's really a young rising scholar, has published quite a bit in academic journals, in popular journals, and it's really been a pleasure to have you over the weekend, to host you and to schmooze with you outside of the formal speaking engagements. And without further ado,
thank you very much. It's really been terrific. I think there's a history of Toronto Judaism to be written. It might be dicey, but happy to be a part of that maybe one day. Today my topic is the Hirshian legacy in, I'm going to broaden it to North America. I think there is something to be said about Canadian Orthodoxy's embrace of the Hirshian legacy. I had published in the last couple of years two tandem articles on the topic of the migration of Samson Raphael Hirsch's teachings to the United States. I found it curious that someone who was so sympathetic to Western culture, to certain ideals of decorum and etiquette, that I didn't hear much about him from my own experiences, my own education in the United States at major day schools that I attended, at Yeshiva University. He seemed not to resonate in the culture in which I grew up as much as I had thought. And so without having a thesis in mind, I explored the sources. I looked and I read widely. And in the end, I came up with an argument in these two pieces that didn't necessarily cohere with the sensibilities of one member of the Washington Heights Breuer's Kehillah, a young man named Elliot Resnick. And when he read my two articles, when he read the two pieces, he felt compelled to publish his own letter in the journal which I published, in Tradition, the academic journal of the Rabbinical Council of America. And if you look, it's a little bit hazy, but he writes as follows. I'll try to make it out and read to you. To the editor, writes Resnick, Zev Elif, that's me, his article contains many oversimplifications and half-truths. To name it, just a two. Okay. What my point isn't to scrutinize the scrutinizer, but rather to look at how he concludes the letter. He writes as follows. Rav Hirsch might not have been quoted much by YU's leading thinkers, except for all the exceptions Elif mentions, including the distinguished Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, but to say that he has very little impact on American modern Orthodoxy's ideology, which seems to be the heart of Elif's argument, is a bit rash, concludes Mr. Resnick, I believe. And he's right. That was essentially the summation of my argument, is that the way that Orthodox Judaism in the United States developed, Rabbi Hirsch, he wasn't taken into much account. On the face of it, that's quite troubling, because after all, here you have the defender of Orthodox Judaism against the onslaught, really was, the onslaught of Reform, an articulate spokesman, by all account, he had great oratorical powers, was widely read, he wrote voluminously, he had a motto. Anybody know what the motto was called? Torahim Derech Eretz. There was apparently it was draped on a flag that hung from the roof of Rabbi Hirsch's day school. Absolutely right. Torahim Derech Eretz, based on a Mishnah and Avot that's discussed in the Gemara and Brachot. Torah, we'll call it, we'll be like safe, worldly culture, Derech Eretz, whatever it might mean. Rabbi Hirsch probably carefully didn't see a reason to articulate a firm definition of what he meant by Torah and Derech Eretz. His successors, his children, tried to, but Rabbi Hirsch, to our knowledge, did not offer a direct program of what Torah and Derech Eretz should be, but that was his motto. And after all, what would one say, I shouldn't take it for granted, is sort of the flagship institution of modern Orthodoxy in North America? Any thoughts? What that should be? I heard about Yeshiva University, which has a different motto. What is that motto? Torah Umada. Seems to me that the founders, actually it came about much later, but the founders, at least of the ideology of Torah Umada, Rabbi J.J. Schachter has an article in which he proves that perhaps some thought it was Torah Uchachma before it was Torah Umada, but at any rate, any way you look at it, they had the option to select Rabbi Hirsch and become to appoint him their spiritual leader, and they chose something else, which says a lot. We talked before earlier about labels. Labels mean something. Titles, designations, nomenclature, branding, it's very important. So I want to start from the beginning. I want to do a survey of the migration of the Hirschian legacy to the United States. Here what you have is the Occident, is an Orthodox Jewish newspaper established by Chazan. He wasn't ordained, by Isaac Leiser in 1843. Isaac Leiser was an arch defender of Orthodox Judaism in America. And here he mentions Rabbi Hirsch. He doesn't come up too often in Leiser's writings, but he does appear in an article in 1856, not too long after Rabbi Hirsch had started his own journal, Yeshurun. They had known about Hirsch. Actually, this is not the first point to discuss, perhaps, of the Hirschian legacy in America. In 1850, another newspaper, one in New York called the Asmonean, edited by somebody named Robert Lyon, had translated, he actually borrowed a translation that first appeared in England, of Hirsch's 19 letters. Hirsch originally, I believe in 1836, if I'm not mistaken, published anonymously the 19 letters, which was a very, both I think in terms of writing, a charismatic and polemical way to argue Orthodoxy's strong points against Reform. And a section of that was published in 1850. I don't know of any Hirschian writing which appears in America, North America, before that point. And in 1856, this is what one of the leading spokesmen of Orthodox Judaism in America has to say about Hirsch. I've blown up page 268, September 1856. We may perhaps recur to the matter hereafter, but for the present, we will let our readers see what a sterling teacher in Israel, Rabbi S. R. Hirsch of Frankfurt, says on the subject in the July number of his Yeshurun. So, what do you get from here already? What do we know from just that information alone? High praise, but something else. What's he reading? He's reading Yeshurun, which means that Americans subscribe to Hirsch's German newspaper. It's important to know, Leiser was born in, there was no Germany yet, but in the German region, that's where most of the Jews who hailed from America, that's where they migrated from. So they were all fluent in German. We are all well aware that Mr. H, why Mr. is a question, defends what the world calls the hyper-Orthodox party, and that he is, from his point of view, opposed to changes not founded on the nature of our laws, and therefore necessarily unfavorably disposed to the French in any modern conference. This article, as the title, as I indicate, the Conference of the French Rabbins, there had just recently been a major conference, I believe in Paris, among the rabbinic elites, and they had there was word that they were going to negotiate certain liturgical reforms in that country. for the Consistoire. And Leeser wasn't very favorable of it, and he borrows from Hirsch, who was absolutely not favorable of it. What's interesting, however, is what is the description? Far from modern Orthodox, what did I read? Hyper-Orthodox party. That says something. What does he mean by no change? It's hard to call orthodoxy a group at the time. There were people who were orthodox because they knew they weren't a reform. But there was a wide array, sort of many, you can plot different people's views of orthodoxy at the time. And Rabbi Hirsch, to the American mind, was seen as something of a radical. He would not have conversation, at least polite conversation, with reformers like Rabbi Abraham Geiger or Rabbi Leopold Stein, for example, his German contemporaries. He wouldn't budge an inch on certain liturgical forms, although I'll point out that in Germany, what was in vogue at the time was to delete Kol Nidre from the prayer book, from the Yom Kippur service. Why? Because if the anti-Jewish sentiment was that the Jew was unethical, then Kol Nidre was the height of immorality. Here was a declaration by the Jews during their new year that they were going to absolve themselves from any requirement to pay off any. Of course, that's not what it means. However, that was perhaps the implication, and they didn't want to give that is the Jews, to the religious ministers who were really monitoring what had happened. Anybody know who the first one to delete Kol Nidre from the Yom Kippur service was? Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. Go figure. Hyper-Orthodox. But be that as it may, despite that one point, that's sort of the exception which proves the rule. In fact, Rabbi Hirsch was not in favor of most changes. I'll give you one other example. The position of the Talmud. What exactly was the Talmud? Where did it come from? So Maimonides famously advocated the position against his forebears that the Talmud, it's midot ha-Torah nidreshet b'hem, the tools of interpreting the Talmud. If those of us who arrive to davening on time, we recite the Ikarim, the essential principles of Rabbi Yishmael, Binyan Av, Gezerah Shava, the tools that we read in the Gemara, we almost take for granted of how they logically determine halacha. That is what Maimonides, that's what the Rambam, the 12th century halachist and philosopher, he deemed to be the origin of Talmud, that the midot, the tools, were given to Moses, to Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai, and everything else was extrapolated from there. The toolkit, so to speak, was given to Moshe, but certainly not every machlok at Abaye and Rava was disseminated at Sinai. Well, Rabbi Hirsch said that's not good, because that makes the Talmud man-made to a certain extent. Rabbi Hirsch couldn't countenance it, despite its logic, despite the fact that there's debates. According to the Rambam, this is quite well and good. Why? Because if you understand that it was just the tools, then one isn't theologically bothered by the fact that Abaye and Rava argue so many times, that Rav and Shmuel, that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai debate. Because then it's not a matter of broken telephone, but it's real-time debate in contemporary terms. It solves the matter of what exactly the Talmud is grappling with. Was it simply that we forgot everything? Heaven forfend, claimed Maimonides. But rather, there was debate about how to properly use the tools of interpreting the Talmud. Make sense? Well, Rabbi Hirsch didn't like that position. Rabbi Hirsch opposed other people who advocated in his own time period, who claimed to be Orthodox in Hirsch's mind. He threw them out of Orthodox Judaism. He suggested instead that every single word, he writes this in several locations, that every machloket, every word of the Talmud was somehow given to Moses at Sinai, and the issue of machloket, not as important to Rabbi Hirsch, because he simply did not want to offer people to the left of him. I don't know if the left means to the modern Orthodox crowd, although it's an anachronism, but whoever else wanted to tinker with certain reforms, it was bad policy to allow them on the condition that not everything was given at Sinai. If everything was given on Sinai, then, as we spoke about earlier today, if everything was given at Sinai, then Moshe Rabbeinu was just as frum, so to speak, as Samson Raphael Hirsch. But if he started to extrapolate the tools, then there was some room for deviation. So Rabbi Hirsch was a radical opponent, and this is exactly what Isaac Leiser is referring to. Another point. This is from a Reform newspaper in Cincinnati. He's in agreement with Isaac Leiser. This is Isaac Meir Wise, the great Reform leader, founder of Hebrew Union College, writes the following. This is actually earlier. This is in response. He, too, was a subscriber to Hirsch's monthly newspaper, and he writes the following. I must candidly confess that we are at a loss to comprehend how a man as highly reputed and learned as Rabbi H. So it's the Reformer who calls him Rabbi H, and it's the Orthodox who calls him Mr. H. Go figure. Could publish an article so entirely unfounded on the history of Judaism and so void of all scientific basis. We conclude our reply for this time, granting the privilege to the friends of the rabbi or to himself. Yeah, if you're going to challenge somebody to a duel, you better give them space in your newspaper. To make use of the Israelite in defense of the above article, we shall then give utterance with due respect to other ideas in which we differ with the learned writer. He's quite respectful, but he can't understand how somebody was so highly reputed in all of the European press could say something which was so anti-historical. It happened to be, it was exactly on what we just spoke about, the history of the Talmud. But again, you have this feeling that Rabbi Hirsch is just not in with the times, with how American Jews, North American Jews, are behaving. So, not important to write that it's not readable is quite all right. This is actually two out of three columns in the Jewish Standard in 1889. Rabbi Hirsch passed away at the very end of 1888. His date, I should have said, 1808 to 1888. And in England, much closer to Germany, they published a pretty substantial eulogy. In fact, you can't read it, but on the right is the eulogy delivered by Chief Rabbi Hermann Adler. I think officially he would become Chief Rabbi after his father's passing a year later, but he was acting Chief Rabbi. And there's a large description of essentially the cavalcade, so to speak, of the procession at Hirsch's funeral. They waved flags. All of his students came. There was there was a lot of showmanship to Rabbi Hirsch, and it didn't end with his passing. Now let's look at the American eulogies. So, here is an article, a eulogy entitled Samson R. Hirsch in the New York Orthodox leaning Jewish newspaper, The Jewish Messenger, January 11th, that should be 1889. So only about fewer than 2 weeks after Rabbi Hirsch's passing, he writes the following. The world sweeps on. That's a eulogy. This is the equivalent of somebody, this was the American equivalent of the most important. By now, the newspaper that I read to you before, The Occident, was out of commission. So this was the leading Orthodox newspaper. So this was the eulogy sort of in absentia because there was no American representative at Rabbi Hirsch's funeral. This is what he writes. The world sweeps on past the nightly stronghold of the Frankfurt community, referring to Rabbi Hirsch, who was the rabbi in his separatist community in Frankfurt. It was reserved for Zacharias Frankel, somewhere in between Reform and Orthodoxy. That's where Dr. Zacharias Frankel resided. He, too, had his own rabbinical school in Breslau, against whom, and the saintly Rappaport, referring to Solomon Rappaport, Hirsch showed the fanatic's hoof to construct a positive historical school which, despite its defects, has ushered in a new era of critical research and popular enlightenment among the Jews of Germany and every civilized land. Again, this is supposed to be a eulogy for Rabbi Hirsch. He's lauding somebody else. It must frankly be stated that Hirsch failed to realize the promise of his early years. He succeeded, it is true, in establishing a strong community in Frankfurt, but not in popularizing his views among any large number. The debates and brochures of the day aroused fresh life in Jewish circles and stimulated a good deal of literary activity, but Hirsch was only one of the giants of his era that counted Zunzring, Leopold Zunz, Rappaport, Geiger, Frankel, Gretz, Sachs. He goes on and on and on, and mentions other Orthodox Jews like Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer and Rabbi Marcus Lehman. This was the eulogy. This was supposed to be an article, as the title indicates, reserved to memorializing Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. And the editor couldn't help himself but to wax nostalgic about somebody else. Astounding to me. Not much changed. So now we're in the beginning of the 20th century. And we can count on three different personalities, three migrant rabbis to America, who might have been successful at transporting the Hirschian legacy to the New World. One was Rabbi Philip Klein, the other Rabbi Shraga Feivel Mendel Lovitz, and the other one, Rabbi Bernard Drachman. I want to say a little bit on each one. Rabbi Philip Klein, and I've given you his dates, 1849 to 1926. He came to America in the later stages. He was a Hungarian Jew, but he had something very important. He married Julie. Julie was a Hirsch. He married the granddaughter of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. And he was one of the founders of the Orthodox Union. For a time, I believe, he was the acting president of what would become Yeshiva University. And even when he died, the newspapers memorialized him as a disciple of the trend of Judaism, which was represented by Samson Raphael Hirsch. But he didn't follow Hirsch. For example, Rabbi Hirsch advocated the vernacular. He wanted his followers, his students, to speak good German. He even Hirsch offered eulogies for important German poets, not Jewish, in his time, because he felt so highly about the German culture. And he advocated this not for Germany's sake, but rather that Jews owe it to their home country to become a cultural participant. Rabbi Klein didn't follow that. And while he was in America, by all accounts, in the biography published by his granddaughter, Rabbi Klein spoke either Yiddish or Hungarian. Maybe he knew English, but he delivered sermons exclusively in foreign languages. He did not adapt to American norms. He was secularly educated, that's true, but we have no books, no writings, in which Rabbi Klein serves as an advocate for the Hirschian legacy. Rabbi Shraga Feivel was probably more hospitable. Rabbi Shraga Feivel was one of the founders and the head of Yeshiva, or at the time, Masivta Torah Vidas. His dates, 1886 to 1948. And he actually got in trouble. So while here we have an advocate, he's in the middle picture. To tell you the truth, one looks at it from 2015 lenses, he doesn't look too modern. But you'll notice that here his beard is kept, and frankly, everyone wore a hat in America until John F. Kennedy's inauguration. This was common practice. This is actually a quite modern look. And he actually advocated, and he read Hirsch, and he got in trouble when he was a student for reading Rabbi Hirsch, somebody who embraced secular knowledge. And when he founded Torah Vidas by memoirists, people who wrote about Torah Vidas in its early stages, he pushed his students to look into Hirsch. But eventually, unfortunately, for Rav Shraga Feivel, maybe for more people than that, he was pushed out of Torah Vidas. He became one of the founders of the day school movement, founded an organization called Torah Masorah. But although he was probably a greater advocate than the grandson or the person who married into the Hirschian family, nevertheless, Rav Shraga Feivel was stymied by other elements, by more extremist elements in Torah Vidas, and was not able to advocate properly the legacy of Samson Raphael Hirsch. Now we get to Rabbi Bernard Drachman. Here's somebody that deserves a serious inquiry. So here's somebody who was successful. Bernard Drachman was educated at Columbia College. He graduated Columbia College in 1882. Immediately afterward, he received a grant to study for the rabbinate in Europe. Well, that grant came from Temple Emmanuel in New York. Temple Emmanuel, as most Emmanuels are not Orthodox. What are they? Reform. So he was given a grant to study for the rabbin. He was an up-and-coming, a very good young scholar. He graduated with high marks from Columbia College, and they thought highly enough of him. They were going to send him, all expense paid, to the Hochschule, to a German Reform rabbinical school, to study with some of the leading scholars of that time. And it didn't work out that way. Instead, Rabbi Drachman was enlightened in his German sojourns, but instead he found Rabbi Hirsch, and I'm quoting from his memoir. He met Hirsch, whom Drachman described as the inspired and inspiring leader in Israel. And so in 1889, Rabbi Drachman offered a much more favorable eulogy than the one we saw in the Jewish Messenger. Rabbi Drachman wrote the following, and by now he was a full-fledged Orthodox rabbi. He was one of the leaders in the uptown community in New York, a very well-heeled congregation, many resources, and he was a celebrated thinker and a celebrated ideologue, and delivered apparently a good sermon too. Rabbi Drachman wrote the following about Rabbi Hirsch just after the latter's passing. He covered Orthodoxy with glory by proving that the old synagogue ritual, so bitterly attacked and described, not only best expressed the true spirit of Judaism, averred Drachman, but could be carried out in a highly dignified, impressive, and aesthetic manner. He didn't disagree with the interpretations of Rabbi Hirsch. He was a traditionalist, an ardent traditionalist, but he saw a beauty to it. And then, as you see over here, in 1899, Rabbi Drachman translates the 19 letters, the first work, the work that actually pushed Rabbi Hirsch. This actually got him elected chief rabbi of Moravia shortly afterward. He didn't last too long, I think only 6 years. But this was his most celebrated work, his earliest work, and Rabbi Drachman took it upon himself to translate, Rabbi Hirsch wrote in very flowery German, very difficult to understand, but Rabbi Drachman took it upon himself that he was going to translate, and so he does. And this is the very first, to my knowledge, full-length translation executed by an American rabbi. And this was a major accomplishment. I'll come back to this in a second. There was another wave of people who might have been receptors of the Hirschian legacy, and those were Rabbi Bernard Revel and Rabbi Leo Jung. Anybody know who Bernard Revel was? He was the very first president and the founder of Yeshiva College. He was very much the guiding light behind what would eventually be called Yeshiva University. And while he did actually dedicate one whole article to Rabbi Hirsch, you don't see much of it. In fact, Bernard Revel was an autodidact, brilliant by all accounts, but he wanted to go back to the original sources. He was somebody who looked in the Talmud, who looked in Scripture, in the Bible, in the Nevi'im, in Ketuvim, for his inspiration. He normally did not look to contemporaries or people from the previous generations. The other person is Rabbi Leo Jung, the rabbi of the, and a very articulate and celebrated scholar, the rabbi at the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side. And he actually studied at the Hildesheimer Seminar. He studied with Rav David Zvi Hoffman in Germany. That's where he had earned his rabbinical credentials. That's where he earned his stripes. Neither one was overly sympathetic. It's true that you can find sprinkled in Rabbi Jung's writings mentions of Rabbi Hirsch, but there's no full articulate exposition of the Hirschian legacy in any of Rabbi Jung's writings. The closest thing you get to is that much later on in life, he commissioned a biography in a book, I believe, called Great Jewish Leaders. He commissioned a biography to be written about Rabbi Hirsch, but much, much later. Now the good stuff. Let's try to analyze why it was that why Hirschianism failed to gain a proper foothold in the United States of America. This what I've given you here.
Do I have to read it?
Not very clear. The remarks delivered by Rabbi Norman Lamb at the investiture of Rabbi Saul Roth, Rabbi Dr. Saul Roth, as the Samson Raphael Hirsch Professorship in Torah Im Derech Eretz, established by, I think, descendants of Rabbi Hirsch, or at least contributors to the Hirschian legacy, at and was held at Stern College for Women on May 6, 1984. It's important, and it's worthwhile to read Rabbi Lamb's introduction to his speech. In many ways, writes Rabbi Lamb, President Lamb at the time, he was president of Yeshiva University, this Samson Raphael Hirsch Conference at Yeshiva University is a historic conference which is long overdue. It is a puzzle to me that Hirsch and his thought were never accorded a full course of study at Yeshiva when, to such a large extent, Yeshiva University is a proud fulfillment of his teachings. This event, therefore, is an act of actual legitimation. The fact that he talks about the donors, Mrs. Hannah Schwalbe, is a great-granddaughter of the legendary Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, and that it is in her and her husband's honor that the professorship has been established by their family, is a happy omen for the future. If, in the realm of ideas, Frankfurt and Washington Heights are really that close, and I'll explain what that means in a moment, can Broadway, where Yeshiva University was on, actually a little bit they were on Amsterdam, can Broadway forever remain the great divide between Bennett Avenue and Amsterdam Avenue? So, let's catch us up to speed. The grandson of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, through his mother, was Rabbi Joseph Breuer, who in the late 1930s had migrated to the United States, and he established his Gemeinde. He established the Hirschian community in Washington Heights. At one point, they actually had 900 members, I believe. This was a major community in Washington Heights that was located on Bennett Avenue. And they preached Rabbi Hirsch, and Rabbi Joseph Breuer was a sincere Hirschian. He was the owner of a doctorate. He preached Torah im Derech Eretz. Some question the extent of Derech Eretz, but then again, one can question the extent of Derech Eretz in Rabbi Hirsch, as we will in a moment. And Broadway is sort of a middle ground between Bennett Avenue, which is the seat of Rabbi Hirsch's grandson, his shul, his synagogue, and on Amsterdam Avenue is the address of Yeshiva University. And therefore, Rabbi Lamb, as he so eloquently did for many, many, many decades, asks, is Broadway going to stop us? Is there really nothing we have to talk about between one another? And then he actually goes on to answer, and he offers a suggestion for why that is so. Before I even offer my interpretation, beyond just the fact that certain people, as we reviewed, either thought that Rabbi Hirsch offered a hyper-Orthodox position rather than, say, a modern Orthodox perspective, and other people failed for whatever reason or did not retain the Hirschian legacy in America, what does Rabbi Hirsch stand for? What are the ideas? What could Torah im Derech Eretz mean? Did he have any positions? Are we familiar? So certainly in the positive vein, Rabbi Hirsch embraced secular knowledge. What type of secular knowledge? Science, medicine, but not Jewish studies, which is interesting. He actually questioned his colleague, Rabbi Israel Desheimer. He questioned some of the students that graduated from the Hildesheimer Seminar. And even in fact, if it wasn't for the fact that Israel Hildesheimer had such great stature, maybe Rabbi Hirsch would have gone after him. If he didn't have such Orthodox bona fides, who knows what would have happened. But academic Jewish studies scared Rabbi Hirsch. Wissenschaft, the Judentums, the science of of Judaism, which really meant Jewish history or Jewish philosophy at the time, was really the tool of the Reform. This was how they performed critical analysis of sacred texts, the most extreme with biblical criticism, but most did not delve into that, but certainly were critical of the Talmud, tried to make it look like it was man-made, and Rabbi Hirsch was scared of it. He, if anything, sniffed of academic Jewish studies. Rabbi Hirsch didn't want any part of it. Well, what about in America? Did the modern Orthodox community embrace in some sense, right? I don't think Orthodoxy embraced biblical criticism, but certainly approaches to Jewish history. All of you came to a lecture on Jewish history. Jewish philosophy? Well, all of the presidents of Yeshiva University, the first three at least, held doctorates in Jewish studies. And so that was one. So there, in terms of the openness to secular culture, Rabbi Hirsch was happy to discuss the wisdom, secular knowledge, but once it intruded on his Jewish beliefs, Rabbi Hirsch was hesitant, if not militantly opposed, to embrace it. What else? Take it from the other end. We as Orthodox Jews living in the modern world attending an event sponsored by Torah in Motion, what do we embrace as the tenets of our Orthodoxy? In this building, for that matter. Where are we? Or Chaim, which is sponsored by? Excuse me? B'nai Akiva. B'nai Akiva is a Zionist organization. I think we can all agree about that. It's a Zionist organization. I think, by and large, one is not afraid to advocate for Zionism in an Orthodox community, maybe in the Jewish community at this point. The Reform was anti-Zionist, was until in the late 1930s. But you can rest assured that if you're invited to somebody's home for a Shabbat meal, you can bring up, you can reveal yourself to be pro-Zionist without expecting to receive much backlash. I think that's an assumption, but that's a safe assumption, that one of the tenets of our Orthodox beliefs is that we support Zionism and, take it a step further, a creed of religious Zionism. Reshit Tzmichat L'Gaulatenu, some people say it, some people don't, but the fact of the matter is we are at least able to consider the fact, and we hope and we pray that the state of Israel is part of the divine plan to bring the Messiah. Well, Rabbi Hirsch was not such an advocate. And even the Agudat HaRabbanim, as they pronounce it, the Agudat HaRabbanim, founded in 1902, the Orthodox Rabbis Organization of America and Canada at the time. In fact, I think there were 100 rabbis who showed up to the inaugural meeting, and about a third, I believe, were from Canada, I think Montreal, not Toronto, but Toronto would grow eventually. They, as their planks, were pro-Zionist. Most of them were. The Orthodox Union, at their inaugural meeting, first they decided whether or not to use the term Orthodox, which is quite interesting, a different topic for another time perhaps, but and they couldn't, the Orthodox Union and its delegates, couldn't agree. They did. They eventually achieved a consensus, but it was far from unanimous whether or not to use Orthodoxy. But once they were able to confirm that decision, that it should be called the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations, then they moved on to the topic of Zionism, and everybody was in support of Zionism. Louis Brandeis became the hero of every Jew in America, or eventually Jew at the time. He was the first Jewish Supreme Court justice. He was a very powerful Zionist, articulated an important philosophy of embracing the democracy of America and Zionism. He wasn't an observant Jew, but certainly an important Jew, and he became a hero for many Orthodox Jews, particularly in the Lower East Side, for not just his social advocacy, but also for his Zionism. So Rabbi Hirsch didn't cohere with the Zionist proclivities. And finally, anybody else know what Rabbi Hirsch was known for? I've alluded to it. Rabbi Hirsch was he the rabbi of Frankfurt? He was a rabbi of Frankfurt. But if you ask Rabbi Hirsch, or you ask his followers? Was he a rabbi or the rabbi? They'll tell you he was the rabbi. Why? Well, Rabbi Hirsch took advantage of a very interesting religious political atmosphere where the Catholics had sued for the right to be their own community. And Rabbi Hirsch took note of this. And he too petitioned the German government to allow his community to separate. Because at the time, you paid taxes to the Jewish community and you allowed the leaders of the Jewish community to decide how to appropriate the funds. They would decide which schools and how much money would go to the Reform school, the Orthodox school, to the different communities, how much went to ritual slaughterers, what have you. And Rabbi Hirsch said, I don't want any of that. And he broke away with 100. And I think he, by the end of his lifetime, he had 1,000 members. And so he created a separatist community. Did that jive? This is going to be hard to read. But what I've provided, we'll deal with it. This is a transcript of the ban issued by 11 Rosh Yeshiva in 1956, protesting Orthodox participation in the Synagogue Council of America. Anybody know what the Synagogue Council of America was? No longer exists. Synagogue Council of America, I'm asking Canadians what the Synagogue Council of America is, my fault. But the Synagogue Council of America was an umbrella organization which represented was supposed to represent the values and the positions of every major rabbinical group, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, and their synagogue bodies and some other organizations as well. And Yeshiva University participated. Rabbinical Council of America, under the imprimatur of Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Rav, participated, and so did the Orthodox Union, some begrudgingly, but they followed the position of Rabbi Soloveitchik that that Orthodox Jews may become members and remain members of the Synagogue Council on condition that the discussions not delve into the theological. If the Synagogue Council wants to advocate for Jewish education, all the power to them, asserted Rabbi Soloveitchik, but better not to have intra-faith, so to speak, dialogue. In 1956, the Rosh Yeshiva asked Rabbi Soloveitchik to sign along. He refused. They also asked Rabbi Eliezer Silver of Cincinnati. He, too, refused. But they issued a ban of Orthodox participation, Rabbi Cutler, Moshe Feinstein. I think Rabbi Kamenetsky was on the signature list. And they banned Orthodox participation in the Synagogue Council of America and the New York Board of Rabbis, which was the New York equivalent, very powerful, being in New York, a similar organization to the Synagogue Council of America. But nobody adhered. The constituents of Revival and Cutler were not participants in the Synagogue Council of America. This was an attempt by one of the presidents of the Rabbinical Council of America, somebody by the name of Rabbi David Hollander. He was the one who posed the question, and it failed. I think the vote was something like 50-7 in favor of continued participation for Orthodox groups, for the Rabbinical Council of America, the Orthodox rabbinical body, in the Synagogue Council. Well, all of a sudden, we've quoted it so many times, might as well bring it up again, the Jewish Observer, the magazine, the monthly magazine of the Agudas Yisrael, of the Aguda, all of a sudden, every single issue, I don't kid you at all, had some mention about Orthodox participation in intra-faith dialogue, in interdenominational dialogue. And very often, who became the hero of the Aguda, which, by the way, some of the writers of the Jewish Observer were from Washington Heights, from the Breuer community, and Rabbi Breuer, too, challenged his colleagues on the other side, beyond Broadway, to release themselves from the Synagogue Council. All of a sudden, Rabbi Hirsch became the hero of the Aguda. And then he absolutely couldn't be if the Aguda took heed of Rabbi Hirsch. And all of a sudden, articles about Rabbi Hirsch appeared explaining how Torah and Derech Eretz corroborated with their outlook. And one of the great expositors of the Aguda outlook, Rabbi Shimon Schwab, who became the rabbi of Rabbi Breuer's Kehillah in Washington Heights, he published a book called Ilu V'Ilu. explaining that one, these and those, it was called, that one could be a yeshiva bachur in Lakewood, and also one could subscribe to Torah Derech Eretz, which he made clear was not yeshiva university. He set certain parameters of what Torah Derech Eretz was, like academic Jewish studies. But Hirsch, all of a sudden, became the spiritual godfather, his Ostritz, as was known separatism. He became the hero of the Aguda, not modern Orthodoxy. Next. Oh, so you can turn it off. I had a feeling. So for these three reasons, again, to review, Jewish studies and Everybody understand what I mean? When I say critical Jewish studies, I don't mean that we're critical of Jews. Critical Jewish studies meaning that to analyze the sources, to write serious history, not hagiography, not gedolim stories, but rather to offer serious and rigorous scholarship. Rabbi Hirsch was opposed to such a thing. Zionism. You just couldn't. Rabbi Hirsch was an opponent of it. And then, probably most fundamentally, because of Austria, because of separatism, because Rabbi Hirsch had separated from the Reform in Germany, he became the rabbinic darling of the Aguda. And if you look at the equivalent, as I have, of Orthodox writing, you simply do not find that Rabbi Hirsch is treated in the modern Orthodox literature. That is to say, he appears in just a few pieces in tradition, in the Rabbinical Council Journal, and to date, there has not yet been published an original article on the thought of Rabbi Hirsch in the Torah Umada Journal, which was founded in the late 1980s. So Rabbi Hirsch became something to the contrary, even though sometimes we speak of him as such. It's important also to recognize, why did Hirsch gain a foothold? If you look downstairs in the sanctuary, you'll see that there's a Judaica Press version, a condensed version of Rabbi Hirsch's commentary to Chumash. Anybody remember what the subtitle is? It's called the Hirsch Chumash. Subtitle is A Timeless Commentary. Why is he timeless? Because he's been in English just as long as anybody else has. Just as long as Rashi has, so too has Rabbi Hirsch. So he's time immemorial as far as the American and the North American mind is concerned. Now I will point out to you that, and this is somewhat conjecture, but Rabbi Hirsch, because many of the followers, those who were in exile after it became, one can understand, at a certain point, one could not thrive as a Jew in Frankfurt. The 1930s. There was an exodus from Frankfurt. Many of the great students and the great rabbinic leaders, Diane Grunfeld, I'm thinking of, Rabbi Schoenfeld, who was another major rabbinic force in England, they migrated to England, and in fact, the original translation, the Levy translation of the Hirsch Chumash, was published by a grandson in London. That's actually the first full English translation of the Hirsch Chumash. He had a much more hospitable welcoming in England. And one might argue, I was looking at a flyer right before shul, and I noticed that the motto of Nitivot, this you'll tell me, what is the motto of Nitivot in the schools in Toronto? Torah, Israel, and Derech Eretz. I assure you, I don't know of any motto of any day school in America which adopts. I know some that adopt Torah Umada, Yeshiva University's motto. But to me, again, it's a hypothesis. I'd like to test it more, but it's important, I think, to bring it up, is that the English folkway, which clearly migrated to Canada, keeps on migrating to Canada to a certain extent. There's almost an Anglophonism. The preponderance of South African accents, English accents, just that I hear over Shabbos. There's an English folkway which migrated to actually built Canada to a certain extent. And so I would argue that I can't tell you for sure, although I'd bet on it, a gentleman's bet, that Hirsch, that what I've said to you might be a little astounding, because Hirsch does resonate, perhaps. The fact that this shul downstairs has the Hirsch Chumash accessible, just as many copies that I noticed as the Art Scroll version, means that perhaps Orthodoxy, or a modern Orthodoxy in Canada was something a little different. I want to close with one final point. This is hot off the press. Rabbi Kelman shared it with me just as I arrived to his home a few days ago. In response to... Yesterday. Thank you. Rabbi Heshi Billet of the Young Israel of Woodmere wrote a letter in the just most recent issue of Tradition in response to a massive article, a halachic treatment of partnership minyanim, the Shira Chadasha movement, and analyzing its halachic validity as an Orthodox institution, written by Dov and Aryeh Frimmer, rabbis Dov and Aryeh Frimmer. I think it's safe to say that they are not advocates of the partnership minyan. Somebody else wrote a letter saying one can't possibly review all their footnotes. I think it's 250 pages long. Rabbi Billet writes the following in response to the Frimmer article that appeared in Tradition not too long ago. He writes, he congratulates the rabbis Frimmer for an excellent halachic dissertation, but he writes, nevertheless, I think it would be an error to launch a crusade against these minyanim. This is not a non-Orthodox venture. We should not lose sight of the fact that while the people involved in these minyanim may be mistaken, they are primarily Orthodox Jews committed to halachic Judaism. They have chosen their poskim and act accordingly. They deserve to be seriously critiqued, but not delegitimized. He continues. The conservative and reform movements of the 19th and 20th century have failed and are no threat to orthodoxy today. I'll offer a note. I'm not so sure about that. It's always dangerous to wax triumphalism at your opponents. Conservative and reform leaders said the same thing about orthodoxy in the 1950s. Always dangerous, especially when you put something in print and somebody like me could write about it. In my opinion, writes Rabbi Billet, to adopt the 19th century banishing strategy of Rav Hirsch and the Chatam Sofer, who was something of a like-minded person. He died in 1839, so he preceded Rabbi Hirsch, but nevertheless was like-minded. In our day is a mistake. And he continues. Here you have it. Consciously or unconsciously, Rabbi Billet is aware that there is a movement to what he calls the banishing strategy of Rabbi Hirsch, the separatism, to call, as we saw with Zacharias Frankel, to banish him, to say you aren't Orthodox, to the hyper-Orthodoxy that Isaac Leeser used in 1856 was, I don't know if Rabbi Billet is aware of Isaac Leeser's words, but nevertheless he is cognizant of its spirit, that the hyper-Orthodoxy was threatening to divide, is threatening to divide the Orthodox community, and I'm not offering a commentary whether he's right or wrong, but what he suggests is that American or North American Judaism should not, and in fact has not historically, subscribed to Rabbi Hirsch. Well, Rabbi Hirsch is a timeless commentary and a beautiful writer. Certainly, heaven forfend, I am not suggesting that we throw away Rabbi Hirsch. My point only is that whereas some might consider Rabbi Hirsch to be the intellectual or the spiritual godfather of modern orthodoxy, my argument is indeed far from it. That in fact, the way we've developed, and if you look, it's always important at a certain juncture in our history to look at the founders. What did they say? I live in Boston. People in Boston very frequently look at the Declaration of Independence. I know people who carry copies of the Constitution inside their jacket pocket. It's important to know how we were founded, and maybe we need to shift course. Rabbi Billet suggests now is not the opportune time to make Rabbi Hirsch the intellectual godfather of modern orthodoxy, and again, I'll conclude, as I've argued, I don't think he ever really has been. Shavua Tov. Sure.
Impact on American Orthodoxy, but I'm wondering if he had any impact on the development of Orthodoxy or religious.
Right. So he, one of his great students, in fact, his grandson was Rabbi Dr. Isaac Breuer. And he actually augmented Torah Im Derech Eretz to Torah Im Derech Eretz Yisrael. And although he was a member, he was a card-carrying member, was Dr. Breuer of the Aguda, he developed a certain outlook of Zionism, which wasn't shared necessarily with the followers of Rav Kook and the Gush Emunim movement, but nevertheless was able to, Rabbi Breuer was able to adapt Rabbi Hirsch to make him, at the very least, a non-Zionist, not an anti-Zionist. And of course, one of the great girls' high schools in Yerushalayim is called Chorev, which is named after one of Rabbi Hirsch's other more monumental works. He has, absolutely. In Bar Ilan, I think they in their archives, they have many of Hirsch's writings. Absolutely. The German transplant to Israel was far better. Some of it was geography, frankly. But there was a way. In fact, even though he was an arch anti-Zionist, the descendants of Rabbi Hirsch managed to find him a place among Zionist thinkers. Whether or not Rabbi Hirsch would have done it is irrelevant to me. What's important is that the Hirschian legacy was able to transform in such a way where it was palatable to be something of a Zionist.
Rather than something that is a product of the tools that the Torah offered us. For a person like Maimonides, the implicit assumption behind this statement is that it came from Sinai. For a person in the 19th century Germany, taking that point of view would mean a license to deconstruct the Torah, which is exactly what they did.
Which is exactly what Rabbi Hirsch feared.
That's exactly what, and that's what he opposed to. So the statement that it comes right from Sinai actually embodies some very fundamental truths.
I absolutely agree.
There's a new tax law passed in Canada. The second that the tax law comes out, a whole bunch of interpretation bulletins come out. The law itself necessitates the interpretation bulletin. The very fact that Moses had to appoint himself and stay all day judging the people, and then at the advice of his father-in-law, appoint sub-chiefs and sub-chiefs and more sub-chiefs, indicates that from the very, very start, from the time the Torah was given, there were already machlokes, and there were all these things to be decided. And the Torah Shebe'alpeh, all it did was basically, I mean, this is simply extrapolating from.
Well, and I agree, and it's a view. It was a view taken up by the Gaonim before the Rambam and Rabbi Hirsch. In fact, if you ask the Rebbe on the street what he feels, he too might articulate, or she might articulate a position similar to Rabbi Hirsch's. Forgive me if I inferred that I disagree with Rabbi Hirsch. I'm a historian. I report the news very, very late, but I report the news, and sometimes I analyze it. I think in his time, and I think a credit to Rabbi Hirsch, he's one of the most celebrated thinkers. In fact, you'll recall that we looked at the editorial in the Reform newspaper. Isaac Meir Weiss, the editor, was shocked. How could somebody with such a grand reputation say something which didn't cohere with his modern sensibility? So even he understood that Rabbi Hirsch was a celebrated thinker and leader. Nobody really contested it. But the separatist German Orthodox culture never quite migrated. One of the interesting questions is, okay, so there was another culture. I alluded to Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, who was a Zionist, who did advocate for Jewish studies, and who wasn't too much of a separatist, although he was afraid to oppose the elder Rabbi Hirsch. Why wasn't he? And I think the answer to that is that none of his works were translated into English. One of the matter is marketing and accessibility. Rabbi Hirsch had every opportunity I didn't go into this in the lecture, but when Rabbi Breuer comes to America, he and the publisher Philip Feldheim go, they develop what's called the Samson Raphael Hirsch Publication Society, I believe it's called, and then it becomes the Joseph Breuer Publication Society, and they publish voluminously. They republish the English commentary in English. They publish their own synthesized commentary. They publish his I think 9 volumes of Hirsch's collected writings. Many more. They've even published a Art Scroll that published the collected responsa of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch to make him into the not just an ilog but a posek, which is quite interesting. That was in the early 90s. Absolutely, there was every chance in the world, but I think at its fundamental core, Torah im Derech Eretz and what it meant to Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch just simply could not resonate with the sensibilities of American Orthodox Jews. Not to say that American Orthodox Jews are more or less Zionist than Canadian Jews, meaning I don't think that Canadian Jews accept the anti-Zionism of Rabbi Hirsch, but I do think that the English folkway did help it out, and they were able to sort of filter what they wanted. But it's a good point. In his time, I'll clarify. In his time, Rabbi Hirsch was one of the great thinkers and leaders, and again for his time, he was absolutely necessary, and he was hugely successful. My inquiry wasn't about 19th century Frankfurt, however. It's a fascinating thing that it seems to me you can do a quantitative study, but I wonder in where I grew up, and I grew up in a period in which the Hertz Chumash was being replaced by the Art Scroll Chumash, but never did I see growing up the Hirsch Chumash. And the more and more I hear, and I asked people this morning about the Hirsch Chumash, and they told me, yeah, not just here, but in other places, there is the Hirsch Chumash. It's a fact, it's a brilliant commentary. And the editor, Gertrude Hirschler, she worked very hard on it. Her papers are at the Yeshiva University Archives. They're fascinating. But it's a real testament to perhaps if we, very too often we conflate, or at least I do, conflate the orthodoxy of an America versus a Canada, and sometimes rightfully so. I think we are part of a bigger network. We in America read Rabbi Bulka, you read Rabbi Lamb, you read Rabbi Soloveitchik. There's a total interchange and of ideas. It's one organism, but in some ways there is a difference. And I'm not prepared to offer firm remarks on it, but I wonder if because that English folkway, I wonder if it's why the Hirschian legacy succeeded far better in Canada. I grew up with Hirsch. Hertz, of course, is English, or he became chief rabbi of England.